Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 135 for March 9th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes.
If you drink Jameson whiskey, you'll find a nice, warming, mouth-coating, smooth texture on the palate. And that's driven principally by the unmalted barley in the mash.
That's David Quinn, the Master of Whiskey Science at Middleton Distillery, the home of Irish distillers. We'll start a two-part series on Irish whiskies heading into St. Patrick's Day later, but first, let's look at the news. The Balvenie is busy with two new limited edition single malts. Last fall, Malt Advocate magazine honored William Grant & Sons master blender David Stewart with a Lifetime Achievement Award, and now Grant's is honoring him with a special 12-year-old release of the Balvenie. It's a marriage of malts from first-fill bourbon casks, refill casks, and sherry butts, and will only be available in the UK. By the way, check the archives for episode 120 from last November for my interview with David Stewart. Meanwhile, Balvenie's annual vintage cask release has been selected, this time by the guys who actually work in the distillery. The Press and Journal reports Balvenie warehouseman Eric Stephen, cooper Richard Anderson, maltman George Garrick, mashman Bill Duncan, and coppersmith Dennis McBain selected two casks from 1976 for this year's vintage release. It'll go on sale later this year for about $800 a bottle. A few weeks ago, I mentioned reports that a group of investors was in talks to buy the mothballed Glenglassaugh distillery in Portsoy. Well, the deal was closed this week. Amsterdam-based Scant Group has purchased the distillery and whiskey stocks from Edrington. It's Scant's first venture into whiskey, but a familiar face will be coming back to manage Glenglassaugh, which was shut down in 1986. Stuart Nickerson has managed Highland Park and Glenrothes and supervised Glenglassaugh after it was shut down, in addition to 15 years at William Grant & Sons. I talked with Stuart this weekend and asked him to explain more about the new owners.
Most of the investors are actually from Eastern Europe, former Soviet countries and Scandinavia. So they're spread throughout quite a few countries.
And looking at the website, it seems like most of the investments are in energy and infrastructure types or projects. Why a whiskey distillery?
Well, they've grown the business through energy trading throughout Eastern Europe and Scandinavia, and they've been looking for some time now to divest into other potential good business opportunities. And the investors all, shall I say, enjoy whiskey, and they were looking particularly for a Scotch whiskey distillery that had a bit of heritage with it. And they've been looking now for some time, and about a year ago they came and discussed it with me, and we looked at Glenglassaugh.
And why Glenglassaugh?
Well, it matched a number of things they wanted. They didn't want a brand new distillery. They wanted an older distillery. They wanted one with a bit of heritage. They wanted one that had some stock, and although it doesn't have a great deal of stock, it has some stock. It's got some aged products. And they particularly wanted one that they felt made a good quality whiskey. And we tried several of the individual bottlings, and they were enjoyed. And that's why we then started to investigate whether it would be possible to actually purchase the distillery.
And Edrington owned it before.
Edrington did, and Edrington have been extremely helpful throughout the process. I knew about the distillery from a long time ago when I used to work with Highland Distillers, and I approached Edrington, and they were extremely helpful from day one in providing us access to the distillery and lots of help.
Now, what will it take to get the distillery online and producing?
It'll certainly take us quite a bit of expenditure, but the main items of kit, the malt storage, the mill, the mash tun, the wash back, the stills, they're all in place, and they're all in reasonable condition. We certainly need to do quite a bit of work to the outside of some of the buildings, again, replace some of the pipelines, the pumps, the heat exchangers, and the electrics. So all in all, we think it's going to take us, from all the indications, it's going to take us about 7 or 8 months before we have that back working again. And surprise, surprise, after 21 years of lying silent, the boiler needs replaced as well. So it's quite a bit of expenditure and a lot of time.
How much stock do you have on from the previous distillery regimes?
Not as much as we would like, but we have enough stock so that we can start to put some out back out into the marketplace. Now, as you can imagine, most of that or all of that stock has to be at least 21 years old, but the majority is going to be 30 and 40 years old. And we're hoping to start a limited release probably of some single cask bottlings of 30 and 40 year old later this year.
And the first single malt won't be available from the new distillery or the newly opened distillery for many years to come.
It won't for many years, no. We might look at something like a five-year-old, depending on how the casks are. But we're going to work with a number of people in selecting casks and making sure the new make spirit is of the right quality. But ultimately, we anticipate it's going to be a 12-year-old malt.
So we'll see the first fresh malt around the year 2020.
2020, I know, and I'm just thinking I'll be a lot older by then as well, Mark.
You and me both.
But I'm sure it's going to be very enjoyable as well.
By the way, plans are to invest £5 million in rebuilding the distillery. I'll keep you posted on when the vintage bottlings become available. Workers at Glenkinchie are putting the distillery's roof back together, not because of a storm, but because it had to be opened up to allow for installation of a new still. The only way to get the still in this past week was through the roof with a crane. Several listeners wanted to make sure I heard about this story. It seems researchers at the University of Aberdeen have figured out a way to take a byproduct of the whiskey-making process and use it for environmental cleanups. It's called the Device for the Remediation and Attenuation of Multiple Pollutants, or DRAM for short. Glenfiddich has supported the project by supplying the byproduct, which is being kept secret for now. See, whiskey drinking really can save the earth. When I was growing up in Indiana, I lived and died with baseball's Cincinnati Reds. Those were the days of the Big Red Machine, and my favorite player back then was Hall of Fame catcher Johnny Bench. In fact, his autograph from back then is one of the only ones I saved. Apparently, I wasn't the only fan. Maker's Mark had planned to release just 3,000 bottles of a limited edition honoring Johnny Bench for the Lane's End Stakes at Turfway Park near Cincinnati. Demand is so strong that Maker's Mark is now doubling production to 6,000 bottles. They go on sale this coming Friday in the Cincinnati area. The proceeds go to the Greater Cincinnati Foundation's Johnny Bench Scholarship Fund and the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Knob Creek Bourbon has announced a series of dinners for members of its Stillhouse Society at the Palm restaurants in New York City, Philadelphia, and Atlantic City this spring. The first one is March 18th in New York. The Glenlivet City Links Tour stops in Philadelphia from the 11th through the 21st. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society holds a Member's Choice tasting in Aberdeen, Scotland Thursday night. The Society's Australian chapter holds a whiskey dinner in Melbourne that same night, and the U.S. chapter has one the next night in Seattle. This coming weekend is Whiskey Live Belgium in Verviers and Whiskey Live Brabant in the Dutch town of Eindhoven, along with Smakoff Whiskey in Malmö, Sweden. March 22nd is the final Woodford Reserve Bourbon Academy of the Year at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky, and the Whiskies of the World Expo is March 28th and 29th in San Francisco. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla at Laphroaig.com. Believe it or not, I do talk about and drink Irish whiskeys at other times of the year, but with St. Patrick's Day coming up, it's a perfect time to look at Irish whiskeys. Irish Distillers is the largest distillery in Ireland. In addition to Jameson, it produces Powers, Paddy, Redbreast, Tullamore Dew, and other brands, all at the Middleton Distillery. This year, Jameson is releasing what may be its most expensive whiskey ever. Jameson Rarest Vintage Reserve is a limited edition with some of the oldest casks of Jameson available. David Quinn is Middleton's Master of Whiskey Science.
Basically, my job entails more on the quality side, ensuring that what goes into the bottle is meets all of the taste requirements and the flavor consistency that's needed for the Jameson brand. So it's essentially on the quality side that I work.
So you're the brains behind the whole operation.
I wouldn't quite say that. There's plenty of others here that would have better brains than I have, but certainly there would be a few of us that would have roles in terms of, we have the master distiller, who's Barry Crockett, we have the master blender, Billy Lighton, and the master of maturation, Brendan Monks, and he looks after the wood, and then myself on the quality side. So between the four of us, we have we try and cover all the angles.
First of all, let's get started with the differences that there exist really between Irish whiskey and Scotch whiskey, because while we know that all Scotch whiskey comes from malted barley, not all Irish whiskey does, correct?
That's correct. What we make here, Mark, is what we've always called Irish pot still whiskey, traditional Irish pot still whiskey. And how that has been made down through the centuries has always used a combination of malted barley and unmalted barley in the mash. So that's where you find the first key difference between, say, Irish whiskey and other styles of world whiskies. And the next major difference would be the fact that most of our whiskies on the island of Ireland and all of the Jameson whiskies are all triple distilled. So that gives a slightly different character to the whiskey. It gives a whiskey that's a slightly more fragrant with a fruity and floral and fragrant character. And, I mean, the reason for that, people ask, well, what does that third distillation actually do? Well, what it does in reality is that during that third distillation, we remove some more of what we call the fusel oils or the higher alcohols present in the whiskey. And they are the congeners that are responsible more for heaviness in whiskey. And by removing, not all of them, but some more than you would normally have removed in a double distillation process, it just allows more of those fruity and floral and spicy characters to sort of shine through and not be masked by more of the heaviness in the whiskey. And then, of course, our style would not have any peaty or smoky character in our whiskey. So that allows, in essence, what that does, Mark, is it allows you to sort of get straight into the complexity of the whiskey without having to sort of make your way through a primary sensory character like a peaty or smoky character. So that's in essence what traditional Irish pot still whiskey is. Just going back to the barley, I often get asked too, what does the actual unmalted barley sort of do, and what's its contribution?
Well, was my next question.
Okay, well, to answer that one, Mark, what the barley does is more to do with mouthfeel and texture rather than a specific aroma on the nose. And what I mean by that is that if you drink Jameson whiskey, you'll find a nice warming, mouth-coating, smooth texture on the palate. And that's driven principally by the unmalted barley in the mash. And that's the contribution of the barley, to give a more mouth-coating, sort of serumy texture on the palate.
And in fact, the balance between the malted and unmalted barley really gives you a lot of different variations that you can work with, because I know at Middleton you produce a number of different whiskies, all with different styles, correct?
We do. We can produce, within the Middleton Distillery, we can produce a range of different pot still whiskies. And what makes that sort of easier to do is the fact of the third distillation, because we take cuts in both the second and the third distillation. In other words, we take a heads and a tails cut in our second distillation, and we also take a heads and a tails cut in our third distillation. There are a number of intermediary types of feints that we produce, and that allows us to actually, using different combinations of feints and also different cutting strengths between in the second and the third distillations, it actually allows us, in effect, to play tunes on the, with the stills and to produce a range of different styles of pot still whiskies with different flavors and different characters. And we will, what we do, Mark, is we would mature all of those whiskies as individual whiskies in their own right, and then have them available as sort of component whiskies or building blocks, for want of a better word, in order to put a range of different blends and types of whiskies together. So unlike, say, with the practice, say, in Scotland, where people would sort of trade with one another and sort of have reciprocal arrangements with each other's whiskies, we're not really in a position to do that here in Ireland because we don't have too many distilleries. So it means that we have to make all our own whiskies here ourselves. And I suppose that's been a good thing for us over the years in that it has driven some innovation. It has driven experimentation and us trying different things to make different styles and types of whiskies. And it also means, of course, that we have total control both in terms of the what goes into making the whiskey, in terms of the ingredients, the water, and the quality, that we have total control over everything we do. So that would be a key difference, I guess, Mark, between what we do here in this distillery and what would happen in other distilleries.
And, in fact, you can actually change the character of your stills to suit the need of the product you're making, correct?
Yes, again, by how we operate the stills, you know, maybe by using different types of distillation rates, which would impact on the reflux within the still, that as well can also give rise to different characters and flavors. And what it means at the end of the day is that we can produce a range of different types and styles of pot still whiskies. And we also can produce a range of different styles of grain whiskies, which we also produce here in Middleton, which is the whiskey that we make from corn, which is part of the overall blend of whiskey. So in essence, within the one distillery, we can make quite a wide range of different styles and types of whiskies.
Is it fair to say that, in fact, Middleton could be almost compared to some of the American distilleries that can take different grains, different styles of stills, and come up with different variations on the product, as opposed to a Scottish distillery that has one type of stills and a house character, and it doesn't change?
Well, certainly in Scotland that would be the normal process, that one distillery will make one style of spirit, and that would be it. I suppose in the American distilleries, again, you will have one type of still in the sense that it will typically be a column still. Certainly they can use different mash bills, in other words, different types of cereals, grains, to produce different distillates. We can effectively take that one step further in that we can also, as well as varying the barley and the malted barley ratios to effect a change, we can also sort of increase that variability by changing the style and type of distillation technique that we will use. So it allows us to sort of broaden our flavor horizon even more so. But that's essentially it, Mark. Yeah.
It sounds like a very interesting job because you're coming in and doing different variations each day on the same theme, as opposed to coming in and turning on the still and basically making the same spirit and putting it in a barrel.
Well, yeah, and it can be a bit of fun. I mean, producing different styles and types of distillates. I won't say we do it every day, but when we will have our production program laid out for the year where we'll know we're going to make a certain amount of, of this particular style of positive whiskey, and then we'll make a certain amount of other styles of positive whiskey. And then when we do have a bit of time, we'll try something different, and we'll try and come up with maybe a different style again. And sometimes it works, and to be honest, sometimes it doesn't, and that's all part of the fun of the experimentation. In some cases, you have a good idea when the spirit comes off the still whether you've got it right or not, or whether it's something different or interesting. And other times, you've got to actually put it into the cask and wait for a few years and let it start to mature and take some samples and get a feel for how that whiskey has started to develop and mature. And it's really only at that stage where you can make a judgment call as regards the character and the quality of the whiskey. So, I mean, it adds a bit of variety and a bit of spice to the whiskey distilling here in Middleton, and it's something that keeps us all interested and keeps our sort of minds ticking over with regard to different styles and types of whiskeys that people might be interested in sort of down the road in the future.
Can you give me an example of one of those experiments that really kind of worked, that you weren't expecting when you tried it?
Well, maybe give you one example in terms of the maturation side. One whiskey that we've just reintroduced back into the United States, and that's Jameson Gold. And while all of our whiskeys would traditionally be matured in seasoned wood, for example, bourbon casks, which would be American white oak casks, or Spanish oak, which would have been seasoned with sherry. And there's very good reasons to have that wood seasoned to allow that first flush of oak extract and tannin to be removed from the cask so it doesn't overpower the whiskey. But with Jameson Gold, we actually put a portion of our pot still whiskey into unseasoned American oak. And that has added an extra degree of complexity and a nice little vanilla top note to that whiskey. And that was an experiment that we did with that whiskey without really knowing what the outcome was going to be. But, you know, luckily for us, it worked. And but you have to be very careful in terms of how much of that type of whiskey you use when you put Jameson Gold together, so that it makes a contribution, it adds an extra dimension to the whiskey, but doesn't overpower the whiskey, if you know what I mean, and doesn't give it too much of a woody character. So that was an experiment that we did that we were happy with, and that worked. Another one was the latest addition to the Jameson family, which is our Jameson Rarest Vintage Reserve, which is effectively our ultimate Jameson. We have some whiskey in there, some of our oldest whiskey, our rarest whiskey, that we had been maturing in port casks for 23 years. And we'd been keeping an eye on it, and we knew we had a small parcel of that whiskey lurking out in one of the warehouses, and we were keeping an eye on it. And we realized in the middle of 2007 that it had reached its optimum maturity. And that's why we decided to bottle it, and bottle it as an individual vintage rather than, I suppose, in effect, rather than losing that whiskey in something else, that we decided to bottle it as an individual vintage in its own right. And that was something that turned out exceptionally well and was something that we were very happy with.
And I was just about to ask about the Rarest Vintage Reserve. Give me an example, if you can, of what the port added to it that you wouldn't normally get from either the sherry oak or the American bourbon or white oak.
Yeah, well, the port, I mean, just to take a step back first, I mean, the reason why port was used at all at the start, and we have other whiskies in port as well, is that port and sherry casks, and also other casks like Madeira wine casks, Marsala wine casks from Sicily, Malaga wine casks from the south of Spain, I mean, they would have been the types of casks that would have been exclusively used for maturing Irish whiskey, in the middle of the last century, and we have documentation in our letterbook showing delivery of fortified wine casks into the distillery in the 1800s. And so it was an acknowledgement of that practice, of that traditional practice, going back all those years ago. And what you find in the whiskey is quite a rich fruitiness coming from the port casks. And when I say fruity, I mean it's almost a combination of fleshy fruit, like you get some beautiful plums and banana even, and some red berry fruits, in addition to how I would describe as like dried fruit, you know, like chopped up dried orange rind or citrus rind, and cherries dried that would have been dried, what we call like a Christmas cake type of aroma. And you also get some raisins coming through. I don't know if that's the same terminology in it, that you would use in the United States, but it's so it's those type of fruity characters that would be contributing from the port cask. But the key thing then is that you want all of those characters to be in balance with all of the other distillate characters that would have come through from the distillation stage, and those characters would be typically floral and a little spiciness and a fragrancy. So what you're looking for is to keep those characters in balance with those nice fruity characters coming from the port casks. And also, there is some whiskey that has been matured for over 20 years in American white oak, and you're looking at some toasted wood, some toasted almonds and a hint of vanilla coming from the American white oak. So the key for us, Mark, is to make sure that all of those characteristics and flavors are perfectly in balance with one another. Because for me, I mean, a real attribute of a classic whiskey is balance, and I think we've achieved that with this particular whiskey.
Now, you mentioned that the inspiration for this was the 23-year-old casks. Do you have enough of this to keep this going on for some time, or is this going to be a limited release?
Well, this particular vintage, Mark, is a limited release in that we had a small parcel of this port-matured whiskey, and we decided that this would be the heart of this particular vintage. And so in that respect, it's a one-off. But we do have other parcels of whiskey maturing in other different types of wine casks that will probably form the basis of the next edition. Excuse me, the next vintage, which will probably come on stream in maybe 2, maybe 3 years' time. So the rarest vintage reserve in that respect is a one-off. What we have available will have to do us for maybe 2 to 3 years, and at that stage we'll have available the next edition. So that's how we see it developing over the years. So it won't vanish once this vintage has been bottled and consumed. We will have a follow-on vintage in a couple of years' time, but it won't be an annual vintage because we just don't have enough of this particular whiskey and that style of whiskey to do an annual launch.
How are your stockpiles of old whiskey holding up?
Not too bad, pretty good. I mean, obviously, whiskey is a precarious business in that sense, Mark, that trying to predict your needs now based on projected demand in 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 years' time is not the easiest thing. So what we always try and do is always make that little bit more and put that to one side. And, you know, if it's needed, fine. If it's not, then it can quite easily form the basis of some new premium sometime down the road. So that's the approach we take because, you know, nobody can get those kind of predictions right. So you just try and err on the side of caution and just try and make sure that you make enough.
One final question. What, if you can tell me, you may not, this may be sort of classified, but what is the oldest cask you guys have in the warehouse?
Well, yeah, we go back to sort of the early 70s. That's about as old as we have. We have some that would be from this particular Middleton distillery. We do have some casks going back before that date, which would have come from the old Middleton distillery. And we haven't decided what to do with those casks yet, but they're only small in number, and they may be released as a Middleton offering sometime in the future to go along with the Middleton 1973 and the Middleton 30-year-old and Middleton 26-year-old that we released in previous years. But in terms of sort of Jameson-related whiskey here in this distillery, you're looking at the early 70s, Mark, as far back as we go.
By the way, the rarest vintage reserve has a suggested retail price in the U.S. of around $250 a bottle. More on Irish whiskeys in the next episode with Colm Egan of Bushmills and Kelly Spillane of Knapaug Castle. Finally, if you'd like to hear a fun story of sacrifice, whiskey, and friendship, you might want to check out Garrison Keillor's classic News from Lake Wobegon podcast from the February 23rd episode of A Prairie Home Companion. I can't include it here for copyright reasons, but check the iTunes Music Store or prairiehome.com and give it a listen. That's all for this episode. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Check out the WhiskeyCast website, where you'll find links for this week's stories, along with the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.